Om Padram Karne Pishunayama Devaha Padram Pashe Makshabhirya Chatraha Stirai Rangai Isushtavagum Sastanubihi Vyashema Devahi Tanyatayuhu Swastina Indro Vridashravaha Swastina Pusha Vishwavedaha Swastina Sarsho Arishanemihi Swastino Brahaspatir Tathatu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. So we're in the Vaitakya Prakarana, the second chapter.
Did we finish 36? I have not finished.
Yeah, we did.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I spent all that time on Jedavat, like a Jeddah.
Oh yeah, the dull lizard one.
Did anybody else think I didn't finish this? I finished it.
I think so.
Yeah, okay. So, 37. Nistu tira nirnamaskaraha, niswadhakara evacha, chala chala niketascha, yatira yadrichako pavet. Yatira yadrichako pavet Nistu tira nirnamaskaraha, niswadhakara evacha, chala chala niketascha, yatira yadrichako pavet, yatira yadrichako pavet Nistutihi Nir namaskaraha nis swadhakaraha evacha chala achala niketaha cha yatihi yadrichakaha bhavet. Last two verses, he's really talking about a jivanmukta, a sannyasi, somebody who has that sarvakarma sannyasa, and somebody who is completely liberated, who has completely gained and assimilated this self-knowledge, and so is abiding in that knowledge and is living a contemplative life. So a sannyasi, somebody who's a sannyasi, a renunciate, is somebody who, for them, their sphere of activity for a sannyasi really is contemplation, studying the shastra, and teaching, and satsang. That's the life. And so that's a very contemplative life. So such a person who's chosen to live that type of a life, how does that person who really is living in this knowledge, who is mature in this knowledge, how does that person live? It doesn't mean we have to live this way. Okay, this is very, very Indian and very much for somebody who has the freedom, even the social freedom, to live the life of a sannyasi. You know, when I first went to India in the 70s, that sannyasa lifestyle was still very much alive. And Swamiji, in fact, when he went up to Rishikesh, so I don't remember how old he was, around 30 or 32 or something. He took sannyasa, his guru gave him sannyasa, and he went up to Rishikesh. He didn't have anything. He just plopped himself down on a piece of land, it's called Puranajadi, right, on the Ganga. And he built his little kutir. Some people came and helped him build a little kutir. He would just sat there with nothing really. And then he went and got bhiksha from the place across the way that was serving bhiksha to the sadhus, and he just kind of developed from there. It just took that sannyasa lifestyle, and he lived it out. And then so many things started happening for him because he was such a wonderful person, wonderful teacher, and he was already kind of well known around India, and so people would kind of make pilgrimages in a way to Rishikesh to come and attend his classes and things like that, and the sannyasis in the area would all come, and so very quickly that ashram built up. Now the ashram is huge, but it used to be very small compared to what it is now. But it built up with having a kitchen, a little, and his little kutir, and then also a hall where at night they could sometimes play music and have satsang. Most of the classes were outside, and they were just right on the banks of the Ganga. Very, very beautiful, beautiful place. And he just lived there and studied and taught, you know, until things started becoming like they are now, slowly, slowly, slowly. But that's how he started. It was a really beautiful sannyasa lifestyle. He had many different students who he had given sannyasa to. And I remember this one sannyasi named Swami Subodhananda. This Swami, his eyes were so bright. He has so much tejas. But he said that what he had done after he'd studied and been with Swamiji for some time and really, really studied the Shastra, and he had this knowledge, but he felt he really needed to do nididhyasana, contemplation, you know, for some time so that his mind would just start learning how to stay home with himself. And so the Swami Subodhananda had a little kutir, a little tiny kutir right next to Swamiji's ashram and on the banks of the Ganga again. And he just stayed. That's all he did is stay in his little tiny kutir and contemplate day in and day out. He would go and get his bhiksha, you know. But other than that, he just stayed in his kutir and lived a meditative, contemplative life for several years. For several years. And then there came a time when he didn't need to do that anymore. He was a beautiful, beautiful man. So I just think when I'm reading these type of verses of the sadhu lifestyle and what type of thinking they have in terms of the lifestyle that they're undertaking and the lifestyle that's in some sense very natural to them in whatever way, whatever environment you find yourself in, there's a certain attitude or a certain attitude that this is representing. So I'll just go through and tell you what it is. The first thing says, for such a person, a yatihi is a sannyasi. Yatihi means one who is disciplined, one who is firm in this knowledge. That's the yati, the sannyasi. So the yatihi. Nistutihi nir namaskaraha. Stuti means praise. Nistutihi means such a person is not going around praising other people, not complimenting, not praising, nor interested in receiving compliments or praise. That type of socializing isn't really predominant in them. It's a quiet, independent life. Nir namaskaraha, nor are they pranaming or bowing down to anybody, nor do they ask anybody to bow down to them. When we do namaskar, whenever I see Swamiji or even an Indian elder, we always namaskar, we always bow down to that person, you know. But for the sannyasi, this namaskaram, the attitude of it is not there. This praise and namaskara, all of this greeting, all these greetings, socializing, social greetings, and trying to praise others or to be praised, that whole realm of activity is something that is not fostered. You know, when I was first at the ashram in 1972, first time I went to India, and I'd been there for about 6 months, had to come home for 6 months, and then went back for 6 months. Went back and after 6 months to be able to go to the course that was starting there. One of the things that I noticed I didn't really notice it until Swamiji told me about it. But people don't look at each other. Like, say, for instance, you know, if we're walking, for me, or for Westerners usually, if you're walking down the street and somebody else is walking, you'll greet them or say hello. Or if it's, of course, if it's somebody you know, then you're walking by each other on a path or down the street, and you'll both look at each other, have eye contact, and say, hi, how are you? You know, something like that. Some sort of a greeting, some sort of an eye contact. In India, they, especially at the ashram, they don't really do that. And it's not being rude or anything. They don't think about it like that. But you're walking down the path at the ashram, and some of the brahmacharis and other people are walking by you, and there's no eye contact at all. They're just keeping to themselves. Of course, here I was, 22 years old, and, you know, friendly person. I mean, I was introvert, but still, I was polite. And so I would, of course, be looking at everybody and saying, hi, how are you? And I think it was disturbing to some of the, especially some of the brahmacharis, and so Swamiji called me in, you know, and he explained to me that actually in this country, in India, this type of, you know, eye contact and greeting and everything is very, very forward. That actually, especially as a young girl, you know, you don't do that, you know. It's not necessary to say hello, and it's not necessary to have this eye contact. And after he told me, then I started noticing that actually there's, now the thing is, there's no rudeness about this, there's no feeling hurt about it at all. It's just the way it is. And it is incredibly freeing. I was realizing I can just walk down the path and I really don't need to look at anybody and I don't have to be polite. I don't have to say anything. I can just be with myself. And it was an amazing freedom because I don't think in this country that we've been raised that way where you have that freedom to just like walk down the hall and not greet everybody that you see. So I started to really appreciate that, and then I'm just wondering that that's kind of what they're talking about, this idea of having to get involved, having to greet, having to say, hello, how are you, how's it going, stop for this chit-chatting. It's not at all necessary. And so the person who has really taken sannyasa and taken that type of lifestyle, that type of friendliness is not necessary, and it does not in any way mean that they're not friendly. Mm-hmm. It's this, just this type of behavior, you know, is not something that they engage in. And as I understood it, the more freedom I felt. So, not only that, the sannyasi is nisvadhakaraha. That svadhakara and the shraddha, these are the rituals that you'll do for the pitras, there's three generations of those in your family who have passed away, and there's rituals that, especially as a male, you are enjoined to do. It's your duty to do those rituals. But once you've taken sannyasa, all of these type of responsibilities, they're karmas that within the culture, there's many different karmas that are enjoined upon you, especially as a householder, you know, that rituals and various things that you're expected to do. And when you take sannyasa, you are relieved of all of these type of karmas. And so this type of socializing, social behavior, and also responsibility to the pitras, to your ancestors, all of that is then given up. And actually, all of those type of karmas they're given up in a sense. But it's a little bit different than that. They're not done, but the drishti that the sannyasi has is now toward all of this realm of activity, that this vyavahara that we experience. All of those responsibilities and all of that vyavahara, and vyavahara means this kind of empirical dealings as a person in the world with all of your responsibilities. All of that resolve into seeing this whole creation as Ishwara. It's an Ishwara Swarupa. And so the whole thing, all of those type of jiva, individual duties that we have, relational duties, are resolved into a contemplative lifestyle where one is seeing the whole creation as Ishvara. So Swamiji in his commentary talks about this, and it's really beautiful. So now what he says here, it's all of these type of vyavaharas, empirical dealings, those things are given up. And then for that person, that yeti, for him or her, he says, for him or her, the niketa, the home base for such a person is chala and achala. Chala is the physical body here, that which is continually changing and moving. Achala is Brahman, the Atma. And so for a yeti, for the sannyasi, the person who has this life's maturity of knowledge and this lifestyle, the ahankara, the I notion, or the I, the aham, has two places where it abides. It abides naturally in the self. When we say, so this is something to really understand with knowledge, as your knowledge becomes clear to you, what was the ahankara? The ahankara means the I notion. What we mean by I notion is that for a person who doesn't have self-knowledge, the I thought, will land on the body or the mind or the sense organs or the moods or the emotions. Even if I say, I am going to the store, I am eating. Right? Well, it's the body that's eating or the prana that's eating. I am thinking, I am seeing. This ahankara is landing in a very real way on the upadis, on the conditioning adjuncts. But so what is the home? What holds the sense of I? What is its niketa? What is its home? Well, the home is, for the jnani, it's going to be two things. The home of the aham is the atma itself. So when I'm just with myself, with no other responsibilities, so to speak, where is my I landing? Well, it lands on me, on the conscious being, on the atma. And so that, the self, that is really the content, what we call the padartha, the meaning of the word I, is where the I sits. And what I mean by that is, if every word that you have, every word, name for a Sanskrit thing for a word is pada. Every pada, every word, as a padartha, it has an object, it refers to something. Right? So there's a very, very profound relationship between the pada and the padartha, between the word and its meaning. So like, for instance, if I say the word cup, C-U-P, cup, that word will bring up immediately the padartha, the object cup, right? If I say lamp, the word lamp lands on the padartha, the object of the word, right? So now what if I say the word aham or the word I? It's a word. What is its padartha? Where does that word land? What comes to mind with that word? I just think like I say cup comes to mind. If I see space, say space. Space comes to mind. If I say rug, rug comes to mind. If I say I, what manifests with the word? What's the padartha? And so for a jnani, one who really has self-knowledge, the padartha of the word I is the atma, is the self, because that is who I am. And so the self is, that yourself, your being, is the niketa, is the home base for the aham, for the I. The other, though, the other place that the I can land on, the other thing that supports the I for a jnani, is the body, is the deha, because it's like this. This body, as long as I have it, it becomes hungry, okay, for food. It's hungry. You haven't eaten. It's past lunchtime. Okay? It's past lunchtime. So the body is saying, get me some food, get me some food. I'm hungry. And so then the I is now landing, even though the body is mitya, that's true, but still the I is concerned now. You're concerned with getting food. I'm tired. The body is tired. Right? I need to lie down. So now the niketa, the home base for the body, is this chola. If the home base for the eye is this chola. So either you're taking care for the sannyasi, either you're taking care of the body, which is beckoning you. You need food, you need water, you know, you need to sleep, you need a certain amount of, you need shelter. So the things that this body requires takes your attention. So sometimes the body itself is the niketa, is the home base for the eye. When the body isn't beckoning you, then the eye is just staying with your being. So these are the two home bases. It's not that when the body is saying, I'm hungry, that all of a sudden you become the body and you're not Brahman. That you're not. It's not that. It's not that at all. You don't. The mithya body is mithya hungry gets the mithya eye. It's not that you lose all of your knowledge. It's just that it lands there because this body needs to takes precedence for the moment. So the point with this achala niketaha, the point is this. For the sannyasi, it doesn't land anywhere else. These are the two sthanams. These are the two places. It's either sitting with me or it's taking care of the needs of the body. It's not landing on what we call a sukha vishaya. Vishaya means an object. I need this to be happy. I need to change this. I need to make this happen. It's not landing there. This is the sthanam. Either your physical body. Sthanam means the place. This is your home. Your home is your body, because you're dwelling in this body. This is your dwelling place. Or the home is just your being. For the one whose mind is reveling in this knowledge, or who is complete in this knowledge. And then what is all this? What is all of this? Because here is this body with sense organs into the world. What is all this? This is all Ishwara. What is Ishwara? Ishwara is the expression of the self. Now, if you say there's a lot of implications here. For one who has, when you have self-knowledge, say I'm talking for all of us who have some self-knowledge, you have a lot of doubts or whatnot, or your mind pulls you away. When your mind is not pulling you away, and you're just nothing, there's no desires have come up, or no traumas are taking place that's pulling you into samsara, then for you, this universe, as it is, you see it as Ishwara. As you gain knowledge, you see this universe as Ishwara. When you're not asking it to be any particular way, then the jiva is not there. The jiva, that in sense of individuality, I am an individual being in this creation, and I have to make my way, and I have to make myself happy and make life work for me. That jiva, you know, who has to control things. That jiva raises its head, you know, as time, until it doesn't. It raises its head as long as that lack of vairagya is there. Lack of vairagya means a certain type of dispassion. Dispassion means this. Just like a child, I love this example Swamiji uses. Just like a child really has no dispassion toward its helium balloon, you know, that balloon is wonderful and it's mine, and I'm very careful to hang on to it, you know, and I love it. It's my toy and I love it. And so for me, for the little child, when that helium balloon inevitably pops, or you accidentally let it go, then there's some sorrow. There's sorrow. There's a lot of joy when you get your helium balloon, and there's a lot of sorrow when you lose it. That is throughout lack of vairagya, lack of dispassion. So that's how what we mean by dispassion. This helium balloon, I want it so much. I want it so much. I won't be happy if I can't have my balloon. That's a lack of vairagya. My ananda, my fullness, is dependent on getting that balloon. And when I lose the balloon, I need to get that balloon back somehow, or I have to get another balloon. I'm very unhappy because I've lost the balloon. That's lack of vairagya. That's lack of dispassion. So what dispassion or vairagya means is my ananda, my well-being is dependent on getting this thing, keeping this thing, you know, and keeping this thing, not losing it, you know. That's a lack of vairagya. Now, if an adult gets the helium balloon, say you're with your child, and your child, you're getting your child a helium balloon, and your child really wants you to have one too, so you both get to have one, you know. And so you get the helium balloon to make your child happy, so now you both have a helium balloon. But you have an objectivity toward the helium balloon. Right? That's vairagya. It's fun. I can enjoy having the helium balloon. I can have fun with it. And if the helium balloon pops, or it lets go, I'm fine. It's fine. I can enjoy even watching it go up into the sky. Or if it pops, that's the way it goes. Inside, nothing is happening. You know? That's vairagya. So vairagya isn't a sour grapes thing. You know? It's freedom. It's the ability to enjoy something when it's there, and it's fine when it's not there also. That's what we mean by vairagya. And so when that vairagya is there, and you have, every one of us has many moments where we're enjoying that kind of vairagya. The moment is fine. I'm not asking for anything to be different. At that time, there's no jiva there. There's just what is there, because there's no one inside that's requiring something to be different. So I have momentary vairagya. But something will always come where the, to break that, because the vairagya is only momentary. There just doesn't happen to be a desired object in my midst at the moment. You know? But what about when I have discovered that this really the truth of it is that the ananda that I thought belonged to the helium balloon or to the jacks or to the new car or to this having this person, whatever it may be, that the ananda that I gain through the gain of this object really has nothing to do with the object at all. Its source is only my own swarupa. It's only my own being. And as I gain knowledge, as I go on assimilating this fact, what happens is one's vairagya goes on increasing, 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 because why would I go out, become upset over an object that really doesn't have it in the first place? So as your knowledge becomes clear, your mind more and more enjoys staying home with the source of ananda, and then enjoying Ishwara, enjoying the world, enjoying Bhagavan's world, but not asking it to be a source of ananda when it's not. See, when we're asking the world to be something which it's not, that doesn't work out very well. And that's why we continually experience this illusion of wanting something very badly, fulfilling the desire, having a moment of happiness, and then having that moment of happiness go away, even though I could keep the desired object. That happens over and over and over and over again. At some point, with all of this teaching, we start to really understand that the only thing that is giving this antakarana vritti, this thought, the thought in the mind, this experience of happiness, is its own state of shanti, the mind's own peacefulness. And that peaceful mind comes every time we fulfill a desire, because whenever you fulfill a desire, at that moment, you're desireless. You've just fulfilled the desire, so you have a moment of being desireless. And in that moment, you feel really happy. All is well with me, you know? And then, things happen out here, like somebody's popping my balloon in one way or another, you know, to make the mind lose its shanti, become agitated. And then this ananda belonging to the mind goes away. It's like the sun shining in a clear water bucket. You know, the sun seems to be living there beautifully in that water. But if I threw some mud in the water, the sun as though goes away. That's what I'm living with in a mind that sometimes is agitated. The sun of my being, the ananda of my being, is not reflecting properly in this mind that has mud in it. And then the mud settles down and the mind becomes quiet, and now this becomes a reflection, and we're, and as though ananda state is existing there in the mind. So ananda is coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, all dependent upon the amount of shanti your mind is enjoying, which you have tied up completely with the fulfillment of a desire. Everybody, every human being, probably even animals, whenever the mind is at peace, that mind is like a clear water bucket. For Jnani, what we realize is that the source of the sun is me. I am the sun. I am the conscious being. I am the ananda. I am the source of the very ananda which the mind can as though cover. As though cover. Because we think that the shantavritti means this peaceful thought, the experience that the peaceful thought enjoys, is the ananda. It's not. The peaceful thought allows for a as though reflection of the ananda. But the self that I am that's illumining that peaceful thought, that is really the ananda, which is never coming and going. This is the tricky thing that we have to understand. For Jnani, as your knowledge becomes clear, what you find is more and more your mind stays home. It likes to be home. So the I, the aham, its niketa, its home base, is the self, because that is the source of ananda. And when it's busy taking care of the body and doing this, then it's taking care of these things. But the ananda, the conscious being that you are, that is illumining and the source of the eye, whether the eye is landing on the body or if it's absorbed into my being, the me never changes at all. Consciousness doesn't change. The wholeness of myself doesn't change. And so for Jnani doesn't care. When he has self-knowledge, he doesn't care really if the mind is resolving into the self, or the I as mithya is taking care of the body. It doesn't matter, because your self doesn't depend upon the I being located in the body, or being located in the body, or located in the self, once the self is known. So, I don't know if you're following, but maybe this will help you. If I say the word lamp, okay, now your mind will go to the lamp or have an image of the lamp, right? But you know what? I don't have to say the word lamp for the lamp to be there. Nothing's happening to the lamp. If I don't say lamp, lamp is still there. If I say lamp, then your focus is on the lamp, right? Now, it's the same with the I. Once you know yourself, once you've removed the ignorance, the self-ignorance, once you remove that self-ignorance that had caused you to take your being to be one with the mind, one with the body, this what we call mutual superimposition, this anyonya adhyasa, once you've removed that ignorance, I am still here whether I'm saying I or not. I don't have to walk around saying, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, I am Brahman. I am Ananda, I am Ananda, I am Ananda, I am the Atma which is Brahman. I don't need to say that. Because the ajnanam, the ignorance, has been removed that has caused the I to be taken, very seriously taken, to be the body, mind, sense organs, and the Ananda projected out. Once you know, once the ignorance is gone, then wherever your the I lands, whether the I is landing on the self, that's satyam, or the I is a mithya I, a hankara, just a functional I, it makes no difference to me, to myself, to my own nature, to my own swarupa. So I actually am completely free. My mind can do what it wants, because I'm not dependent even on what type of vritti or thought modification is there in the mind. What difference does it make? If the mind is a happy mind, if it's a tired mind, if it's an agitated mind, you know, if it's a involved in perception, if it's reading, if it's communicating, if it's talking, if it's meditating, these are all activities of the mind, every one of which equally enjoys my own being, which is not involved in any of that. It's not as though the mind, which I am the self of, which I illumine, is changing by the quality of the mind. Think of it like this. The sun is shining, right, on the water bucket. It's illumining the water bucket. Okay. The water bucket is muddy. The sun doesn't become muddy, but the quality of the water is such that it is really not resonating with the nature of the sun. But from the standpoint of the sun, which is illumining the non-resonating muddy water, nothing is happening at all. Zero. Now say the sun is illumining the really clear water bucket. Still nothing is happening to the sun. The sun just remains as the sun. So say the water bucket is really, really clear and the water is having a great experience because the water is resonating in its nature, is familiar, is resonating with the nature of the sun. But from the standpoint of the sun, the water can be clear, it can be agitated, it can be muddy, it can be whatever it is. And that's the water's problem. You know, it's not my problem. I am there as the very changeless self, illumining the very set chit, illumining the changeless being that is there, present to whatever mental condition is there, to whatever perception is there. That makes no difference at all. And so say I've discovered myself, say I've discovered the truth of that, then whatever is going on in the mind and whatever is going on in the world, I can be objective, I can help, I can do whatever needs to be done. But whatever is going on, I can do my best to help. I can do inner child work. I can work on the, I can help the mind with whatever values it's missing or whatever desires are there, whatever ajnana, whatever ignorance is there, whatever its shortcomings are, whatever. I can help. But nothing's happening to me. Nothing's ever happening to me. And my nature is the very source, the wholeness itself, the self that can't be improved upon. So for such a person, I'm not going out trying to make myself happy. I do take care of the needs of the body, because when the body's hungry, it's hungry. When it's tired, it's tired. When it's sick, it's sick. I take care of those needs. But does it go much farther than that? Yeah. And now let me have this, and now let me have that. Why it doesn't go farther than that is because I'm fine with Ishvara. This body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of Ishvara. Just like if you dream, if you have a dream, your body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of that dream. It's part of the whole. It is living out in a dream. Your body, the body that you've taken in the dream, is living out the story of the dream. Right? It's not the... That character is part of a bigger story. It's easy to see that in a dream, right? It's that the character is not ruling the dream. The dream is the story, and the character has its part in the story. So here in this universe, I am part, I have a role. I am part of the bigger story. And so I'm fine with that. So let Ishvara's story unfold. But as Ishvara's story is unfolding, I find myself in this place and this place and this happens and this happens and this happens, and I'm responding to the creation. I still get hungry. I still have to go to sleep. I still have to take care of my wounds. And so I have those responsibilities to the body which I take care of. But I'm not asking Ishvara to make me happy, because the source of happiness is my own being, which is Ishvara's own being. There is no ananda in the world other than the ananda that is my own nature. And so that becomes very clear. And that being so, then he says, yatihi Yadrichikaha Bhavet. So such a yeti, such a person, sannyasi who has knowledge like this, what do they want? Well, whatever comes my way. That's what Yadrichikaha means. The circumstances that unfold, the circumstances that come my way, that's what I respond to. Like what Swamiji always says, whatever is here, I do my best. Moment to moment to moment, I respond. Whatever is here to be done, that's what I do. That is a lot different than taking on an attitude where I am a conscious little bubble, jiva, in this inert world, and I have to carve my way. It is my responsibility to make it successfully to the end of my life. You know, I have to make a successful life. It's my responsibility because this is an inert world. Whereas from this drishti, from this vantage point, the life that the thread of my life from beginning to end is part of Ishwara's story. And so that story is fine with me. The reason it's fine with me is I was born for it. This body, mind, sense organs that you have was born part and parcel of the story that you're living out. And so why not be satisfied with this story? Whatever the story is, there are a million stories that you're missing. Right? You can only have one story at a time. I say one of the things, I know I say this often, but one of the big things that Swamiji told me just at the right time, you know how that is, and get the little drop of wisdom at the right time. He said, you should be happy with what you have. Learn to be happy with what you have. Because what you don't have is infinite. So what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. You know? So enjoy the life that you have. And then, so that's what I do. I enjoy the life that I have. I do my best moment to moment. I do what needs to be done moment to moment. There's nothing more to it than that. Now, there is nothing more to it than that, really. You think there is. You think there is because you think that you have to make a happy life for yourself. But what about when you discover that the only ananda that exists is the nature of one's own being? That there is no magical ananda out there for you to achieve. That it's your very swarupa, it's your very nature. And you start to understand, there's so many ways we unfold this, you start to understand this grand, grand illusion. And the key is this: I want this object so that I can be happy. So just remember back, even a few moments ago, however long, just remember back. Everything is fine. You're just peaceful. Everything is fine. And then a desire arises. Okay. Now once the desire arises, now everything isn't fine because the desire is like an irritant. This is something, the desire is something you have to attend to. And so now things divide up. There's the object that I need. There's the people that help me to get it. There's the people that, you know, are obstacles, situations that are obstructions, situations that are helpful. And the world divides up into this. My desire and what is helpful and what is not helpful. So now it's not Ishwara anymore. It's me and my desire. And Ishwara is either blessing me or he's being bad. Even Ishwara. Ishwara is either going to help me, oh please, please, please help me. Or Ishwara is denying me this. The whole world divides up around this desire. When you are lucky enough to fulfill the desire, after going through all the stresses and strains of trying to fulfill the desire, when you're lucky enough to fulfill the desire, what happens is that all of those stresses and strains at that moment disappear. And your mind is set free. It's like a clear water bucket, and you have an experience of ananda, because the mind is now in a condition which actually in the Upanishads call this condition of this clear, quiet mind that's like the reflection of the sun, just an anandalesha. It means it's just a little speck of ananda. It's an anandalesha. Because the ananda really is my own being. And that, but the thing is, this being is not, it's not a brilliant bliss ball. You know, you need a special type of mind for this bliss ball. But the ananda of my being is so whole and complete and quiet and unassuming, and it's something that can't be improved upon in any way. That me reflects in a quiet mind in different varieties of forms of bliss. In an agitated mind, like muddy water bucket, that mind is non-resident. It's like having a foreign body, you know, inside of me. And so I tend to go, the mind resonates from darkness to bliss, from sorrow to great happiness, with great extremes. It's going back like this, it's like a pendulum, this way and this way and this way. Sad, happy, sad, happy. But I'm not sad or happy. My being is not sad or happy. My being is the sun. And it is always stable, it's always whole, always complete. That's what I have to discern. That's what I have to discern. Mm-hmm. Not this. These are vrittis. These are thought modifications. Peaceful ones, agitated ones. Peaceful ones, agitated ones. I like the peaceful side. I don't like the agitated side. But I'm me, the self, is neither one of those. So as my mind, as I get this, my mind starts staying home. And as it stays home, it relaxes. You know why it relaxes? Because nothing in the whole universe can take me, the Atma, the self, away from that mind. The mind cannot be away from the self. And the source of ananda is the self. So the mind has no fear. Anything out here, it can lose and will lose. Any mental condition, any thought, it will lose. Their mind goes on changing. But what never changes, ever at any time, and cannot change, is that the very swarupa, the very self of the mind, right, that is free. That doesn't come and go. And so when the mind discovers that, it relaxes into myself, and then it naturally enjoys ashantavritti. So it naturally enjoys peace because the fear is gone. You don't fear something that you can't lose, that you can't, that nobody can take away from you, that you can't even take yourself away from it. You can't do anything about it. And so the mind relaxes. And the mind relaxes, it itself enjoys peace. The Atma yourself always enjoys peace and fullness. And now the mind as a little mirror gets to enjoy it too, because it's relaxing into yourself. That's the incredible freedom. When that's your reality, then whatever comes your way is fine. Because I'm not dependent on Ishwara, I'm not dependent on the universe, or I'm not dependent on any person to give me something to make me happy. Nor do I expect to think that there's any ananda there. You say the whole universe rests in the reality of the ananda, which is my own being. And so that's what allows the yeti, or the one who has jnanam, like that, to take things as they come. It's fine. And this is fine, and this is fine, and this is fine, because this is what's here. That's why it's fine. This is what's here. This is what's here. This is what's given right now. This is what's here for me to deal with. That's the incredible freedom. None of this that's here for me to deal with right now in any way can touch the wholeness of my being. And so that's the freedom of the jnani. Mm. We'll do the next verse, our last verse in this chapter. We'll do it next week. Okay. Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Understand the whole thing. I wonder how, like, we're meant to understand the desire and the pursuit of knowledge.
They call it the only benign desire. The desire for the mumukshu, you know, that desire for liberation is the only benign desire because it actually solves the problem. Mm-hmm. But the desire itself creates the same stress, you know, because. You know, am I gonna get this knowledge, and am I gonna get my visa? I remember that one. My visa's running out, and what's gonna happen to me? And I'm gonna miss my classes, and you know, all of that angst over the fulfillment of the desire of gaining that knowledge.
Or is my dispassion gonna be good enough?
Yeah, whatever it happens to be. Because the desire resolves into the source of ananda, it's benign. But no other desire really resolves into the source of ananda. You know, and so it's temporal. Any fulfillment that you get from the fulfillment of that desire, even if it's a positive desire, still the result, the ananda that you're seeking is time-bound. Even dharma, which is probably, you know, to have an attachment to dharma is probably the most benign attachment that one can have in the world, in a sense, because dharma is really, in a way, as I was saying the other day, it's that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, because Ishvara is dharma, really. But dharma has to be maintained. It still exists within time. You can do one dharmic action, but the next action is not dharmic. Mm-hmm. And so then you're accruing the results of that adharma. You know, so whatever attachment you have or desire you have for something that exists within duality is fraught with fear. Mm-hmm. Even then the Taittiriya Upanishad, even the slightest duality is a source of bhaya, fear. Because it's subject to change, different than you. It comes and it goes. And so any pulla, any result that you're attached to through the fulfillment of whatever act is, that is a source of fear. You can say attachment is a source of fear in the world, because attachment to something that by nature is going to go away is a source of pain.
Sense in which you're kind of seeking for your experienced it a different way, right? I mean, that's an important way in which the desire for liberation is that.
The desire for liberation is, I didn't hear the last part.
Is the desire for your experience to be another way than it already is.
See, the thing is, if you become a mumukshu, means that you want liberation. You have a desire for liberation. That means that you've recognized certain things about the world, or you won't have that desire. So what you've recognized about in the world is that by the very nature of the world, what you seek in terms of any type of human wholeness or completeness, where you can just relax and say, I am full, I'm complete. Everything that needs to be done is done by me. If there's an end game, that's not possible. So say if you have a moment of happiness. I remember when I was around 18 or so having this particular experience of where I just had experienced kind of a deep wholeness, a deep happiness. And I remember very vividly watching it fade away. and trying to hold it and trying to get it back. And I couldn't. But I knew that's who I was. I knew that's how it was supposed to be, you know. But I couldn't hang on to it. Swamiji sometimes jokes that, you know, in India, the Madras coffee is so... We all love our Madras coffee in India. And he said, you know, there's that perfect cup of coffee, Madras coffee. And then, so you've had this perfect cup of coffee, and none of the other cups are living up to it, you know. So you get these moments of deep fullness, deep ananda, deep well-being, and they slip away. And so there comes a point when you recognize, you know, within time, within duality, everything slips away. So just by the nature of the creation, there is no experience within time that doesn't slip away. Even if you look at the mind itself, the mind is not stagnant. You can't take, it's not like a snapshot and you can freeze the mind. And so then you start to realize that sense of deep well-being is not something that I can attain from the world or from the fulfillment of any desire or from any mental state. That's a big thing to realize, that it's not going to be, you're not going to get that from a mental state. Because mental states themselves change. And so if that moment of happiness, if all that is a mental state, then it's kind of a hopeless situation. You just have to be content with the way things are, that it's just a continual flux. And there is no really any freedom. There's practices that you can do. You can have practices that make things better as long as you keep the practice up. What?
And I was like, as long as you do the practice.
As long as you do the practice. But that's not really freedom, that's maintenance.
Yeah. Right. One thing, you know, this this is like the fruition where the person just supports the body as it needs to be supported and takes whatever comes, because they know that the true happiness is the self, is from the self. It has nothing to do with the external. And for a sannyasin, that seems fine. Or for a person even here, maybe, who is retired, doesn't have to work, that could work, like me. But I sometimes think, like, what is someone, you know... I have this image of someone going to a job interview and they think, well, where do you see yourself in 5 years from now? And saying, well, I see myself having my body sufficiently supported so that, you know, and doing my job responsibly, yeah. But basically wanting to just support this body so that I can then revel in the self as much as possible.
Next.
I don't know how you know, and it also has to do, like, with this whole thing too, that you're just identifying the aham falls on the body when it's needed, only when it's needed, and otherwise on the self.
But here too, you know, society expects you to have some sort of a self-image. I mean, this is a little bit different, but somewhat related. I just think, you know, for people who have to actually make it in this.
In the previous verse.
Yeah.
That's where why it says in the world, it's you just act like are an ordinary. You just behave like an ordinary person in the world.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's what they meant by that Jadavat. And in fact, in also in Panchadashi, there's a really beautiful verse. You know, that says really the Vedanta or your knowledge is not table talk. It's something that you share with your students or in satsang.
Right.
It's not something that you bring into the world because it's meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
If a person's not a mumukshu and they don't care particularly about any of this, it's not something for you to talk about with them because it makes no sense at all and it's not appropriate.
Right. But the thing is, again, you know, if someone, the thing is, if someone is in this culture and society where everyone is expected to have ambition, to be, want to become something, become somebody, and all the rest of it, you know?
Yeah.
And yet they really don't really care about that. They want to just realize the self or have self-knowledge.
Yeah.
And that's really, and they're willing to do what they need to do to work responsibly and do their job well and all that. But they are going to be asked in being the fool, in acting like a fool, as he says, they're going to have to pretend in some way, I think, they will almost inevitably have to pretend that they care about a lot of things or that they are something that they actually are not. I just wonder how people would deal with someone was genuinely just, you know, devoted towards moksha, but then in this culture they're really expected to, you know, there's a lot of things they're expected to do in order to sell themselves, let's say, to an employee and employer and all the rest of it. And they're expected to have an image that they are ambitious in some fashion or another in a material sense.
You know, I don't think having self-knowledge makes you in any way incompetent.
No. Right.
You know, and so what that means is that in any given situation, you can be objective and do what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a person who has self-knowledge is actually very easy to be around because they're not asking you to be something different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so a person that's self-knowledge, that's different than somebody who's trying to be like a something or other, like an enlightened person. But if you're just a regular person, which you should be, just a regular person who has self-knowledge, then you just deal with whatever situation your prarabdha brings. And the thing is, whatever situation it is your prarabdha.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do belong there in that situation. And so that means because if you belong somewhere else, that's where you would be.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means then is that you can just be totally present to the situation you find yourself in.
But I think what, I don't know if you were asking is, you know, how do you see, if the employer asked the employee, how do you see yourself in 5 years? They'd want to see, are you really ambitious? Are you really a go-getter? Are you really all this that's just going to, you know, be part of the team and everything else? And, you know, is that kind of like?
Yeah, I guess if you were in that situation where that's the kind of job and that's the life that you are living, and you will, that's the situation you're in, so you have to just deal with that.
Because remember, Vijay Kapoor had a very prestigious job at Hewlett Packard.
Yeah.
And he left that position, you know, to go to Piercy, right? And then he came back, and he got his job, you know. And what position did he have? I don't remember.
Yeah.
He got his job back.
Yeah. It's just
also, Steve Nizaborsky also got his big job at Hewlett Packard. But see, the problem is this. You're going back in as a jiva who has to make it work, who has to play the game, instead of just thinking more realistically, actually, is that every moment you are in your whatever situation is brought to you, and you belong there.
Right, okay.
And so whoever you are in that situation is who you are. Do you see what I mean? You belong in that situation. Yeah.
Theoretically, it's more difficult than actually dealing with the situation that you're actually in. In other words, asking about it the way I am theoretically is more problematic in a way than...
Yeah, the way you're talking about it is not the way it is.
Yeah.
Because the way it is that your life unfolds. The prarabdha unfolds. And so every moment, really, you are in your life and you're a player in your life and you have a place here. Like each one of us here right now, we have a place. Here we are. I'm sitting on this chair, you're sitting over there. We have our place. And we're with our people.
Yeah.
Wherever you are, you're with your people. These are your people at this particular time, you know? And so what's great is that if you're not asking everybody to be a certain way so you can be happy, you actually become a relief in the group because you can support other people and let them be happy and let them be ambitious and you can help them along the way and, you know, you can do what you need to do too, whatever, because you're going to be called, have certain responsibilities also. Like, for instance, you're a lawyer. Say you were called into court to... You can't just sit there like a gnani and say, oh. That's not being a gnani, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Gnani means you have knowledge and you do what needs to be done. And that can, you know, be very, you know, you can have to play hardball sometimes because that's your job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That raises for me a corollary question, which is, so the sthanam lands for sannyasi on the body when necessary, but otherwise on the self.
Yeah.
If someone is in the world or being a lawyer or whatever,
yeah.
Sometimes the sthanam might land on more than just the immediate bodily needs, but, well, I've got to get through this trial or whatever it is. I mean...
That's true. I mean, if you're having a sannyasi lifestyle, you can kind of limit it to that. But what they're really talking about is... What are you asking for in terms of ananda?
Mm-hmm.
It's not about objective responsibility. Like, say you have a trial. There's all the stuff you have to do to prepare for that trial. That's part of the job. And you just take it one step at a time. This needs to be done, and this needs to be done, and this needs to be done. If you're doing that job, you do the best. That's what Swamiji says, I do the best to my ability every moment. So now I'm doing this, and then I have to do this, then I have to do this, then I have to do this. That's just objective.
And while doing that, the sthana might land on elsewhere than the self or the immediate bodily needs. It might be on, I've got to do these things.
No, because that's just objective. That's not landing anywhere. Landing, you know, is I need this to be happy. I need, this becomes the self. You see, this body can become the self as though. The Atma is the self. That's where I will reside. But for a gnani, one who doesn't have knowledge, your objects of desire become the self. That's where the I lands, because I need that. But what I'm needing is myself that's been projected over there. So I land over there. That becomes myself. See, every time you say, I need that to be happy, you're projecting your wholeness, your ananda, onto that object. So now you're landing over there. But what if you're not projecting your being, your wholeness, onto anything in the world? Then what's going to get it? Okay, either your mind is just abiding in yourself, or it's taking care of this body. I need food. I need to sleep. I need to take my medicine. Right? Those are just taking care of the needs of the body. Which is kind of this is your home. Either on an absolute level, the Atma is your home. On a level in the world, this is your home. You can't get rid of it until it dies.
So perhaps
you take care of it.
The needs of the body are just a little more complicated. We might have to do a few more things.
You have to do what it's called for to do.
But it's still sort of the needs of the body. We're not talking, there's only those three places, really, for the...
What's the third?
Well, the objects in the world that you might mistake.
Yeah, because what... I can mistake myself to be the Atma, to be this body, right? Or to the mind or the sense organs. These are called upadis. But there's something else that we teach also, is that these objects of desire, I'm also projecting myself, my being, onto that object. My being in terms of my wholeness, my ananda, which is really my very swarupa, it's my very nature. I'm seeing it out there, right? And so I, in fact, am landing out there. I'm not just landing on myself or on this body, which is a home as long as I have it. But this is where I'm located. The buddhi, everything is located here. But I also land out there. And then that becomes really treacherous. Because my very being is out there, and I have to get it back. Right? It's not true, right? But that's the illusion. The ananda is projected out there, and I have to go and get it. Even though, actually, it's never been there, but I think that it is. And so what in Shankara says in his commentary, you know, it's when you say that chala achala niketa, they're talking about the Atma in this body as opposed to any vishya. Vishya means an object that you take as a sukha vishya. You know, sukha means this object will make me whole, make me happy. That's a projection. That's where it doesn't land. And when it doesn't land there, because I know that ignorance isn't there, then I'm just objective. I can participate in the world. I can be with you, I can enjoy you, I can help you, you know, because I don't need you to be in a particular way. And I don't also need to gain all of this stuti and, you know, this whole stuti and namaskar. I don't need that. I don't need to be praised, and I don't need to praise you or not praise you. I don't need that. And I don't need to have you bow down to me, and I don't need to bow down to you. These things are not required. I don't have to kiss up or anything like that. I can just be helpful. I think I like that. But Swamiji said that so many times that it really sticks with me. Just do the best that you can and be helpful. That's what's natural. Mm-hmm. It's not natural when all of this other stuff is happening.
You make it sound like you can't hurt me or damage me or be away from me.
Well, that's the truth of it. But that me has to be recognized. That's the Atma. That's the freedom. It's when you realize that yourself, you can't improve it. That's a huge relief. And you can't make it work. You can't hurt it. You can't get away from it. And nobody can take it away from you.
And it's not a loser.
It's whole and complete. It's not a sad loser.
Sophie, if you're doing what needs to be done, what's right in front of you, and that thing happens to be something really kind of intense and all engaging, like, say, doing a trial, putting out a fire, you know, whatever it is that your job is, serving a bunch of people as a wait person, whatever. And it's so engaging. Would a person who has self-knowledge be, how would their engagement, would it be any different from someone who doesn't? Or would they be so, I mean, some situations require so much of a degree of engagement, you have to be so fully involved, that it doesn't seem like much of your attention, much of your RAM, so to speak, would be... attending to the self?
You know, that's a really important question. And see, when we say self-knowledge, what we really mean by that is what we call ajnana nivritti, the removal of ignorance. When ignorance is removed, then the nature of yourself doesn't have to be continually fed. You know, like, oh yeah, I'm Brahman.
Like as a mental state.
Right. It's not a mental state.
Right.
The ajnanam has been removed, the ignorance has been removed, and the being that you are, that has always been self-evident as conscious being, is now the mind no longer takes it to be, belong to itself. There's a viveka there because the ignorance has been removed. And so you don't have to keep telling yourself that you're the Atma. You are the self, and that's self-evident. And so now say your mind is busy, it's very engaged in all of this. Still, the center of your being, the me, is still the Atma. You don't have to be saying, I'm the Atma, while you're engaged in this very tense thing. You're free to be engaged. It doesn't hurt you to be engaged. You can be very, very engaged. You can be very single-pointed. It doesn't hurt you at all to do that. Because yourself is not covered. It's never covered because the ajnanam is removed. It's like the clouds don't cover the sun. The sun illumines the clouds. The clouds can never cover the sun.
And
from the standpoint of the sun.
The self is never covered, and there's a difference between, for such a person, doing nitya dhyasana in a quiet contemplative place and being in this engaged activity.
Well, for Jnani, no, there really isn't.
No.
There's a difference in the state of mind because the mind in nitya dhyasana is relaxed and just focused on me. And when the mind is engaged, then it's all involved in all of this other stuff.
And
it's not
focused on me so much.
Right.
That's my
question. Yeah, it's not. It's not, but you don't need to be focused on because you are you.
So you don't have that as a need. I mean,
because you don't go anywhere. You don't go anywhere. The mind is doing this and doing that. You're still the same self-evident me. There's no ignorance there.
Well, you're the same me, whether you're contemplating or completely engaged.
Yes, because the self is the one that is really illumining the mind. Right? It's not the mind that's illumining the self. You've removed the ignorance. So I, like a self-shining me, is ever present no matter what my mind is doing. I don't need my mind to tell me I'm me. I've gotten rid of that ignorance that caused that mistake.
So the self.
And you might like to contemplate. There's nothing wrong with that if your prarabdha is such that you can sit and contemplate because you love to do that. That's a beautiful thing. But it's not that you have to contemplate. In fact, Shankara in his Aparokshana Bhuti, the last like 20 verses or so, he's saying, do you think you have to sit to meditate? You don't have to sit. Why, you're always nirvikalpa. Yourself is always nirvikalpa wherever you go, right? It doesn't make any difference.
So this self-evident me kind of announces itself once you have some knowledge, some clarity. It announces itself by itself. I mean,
It's self-shining. It's the conscious being, so it's not announcing itself anew. When you gain self-knowledge, you realize that, oh, I've always been here exactly as I am. I just didn't recognize.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't recognize my own freedom, the freedom that's always been here. And I see that very clearly. It's like in the 10th man story, when the 10th man discovers I'm the 10th man. You know? He has always been the 10th man, and he knows I've always been the 10th man. But I got waylaid. But I've never not been the 10th man. So it's the same. When you gain self-knowledge, you recognize I have always been free. I've never not been free. This me, this is the same me that was there before I got knowledge. It's just I hadn't recognized. I hadn't recognized myself as free. Yeah. It's beautiful. Om Tat Sat. Yeah. That was good for tonight.